good afternoon, and welcome to Money Talk. I'm Carl Stewart, and you're listening to News Radio KLBJ. Thanks for listening. We're here this afternoon after the news at 4 until 5, coming up here fairly soon on our 25th anniversary broadcast. Speaking of broadcasts, I hope you enjoyed, if you're a regular listener, the last 2 weeks of our evergreen broadcast. I want to thank Patrick for doing such a great job, and of course, always my friend, Dr. Kenneth J. Rahmeyer, for helping me with that, and I hope that you have enjoyed it. We've gotten some positive feedback about me having the opportunity to bloviate. Kenny says, I don't like to bloviate, but he thinks there might actually be some value to that. If you know my wife, be sure and tell her that. This is Money Talk, a broadcast about the world of financial and investment planning, where you always determine the agenda by calling or texting 512-836-0590 or calling me at 877-590-KLBJ. Also, you may listen online right now at newsradioklbj.com, or if you prefer, you can go there at your convenience and download podcasts of the last several years of Money Talk. It's a great idea to call or text at the beginning of the hour. That way, I'll make sure that I have an ample opportunity to do my best to answer your questions. I did get some feedback from our longtime and regular listener, Bob in Arlington, that I said something incorrect in our first Evergreen broadcast. So it has to do with something called QCDs. What the heck is that? It's a qualified charitable distribution. And if you are in a position where you have to do a required minimum distribution from your IRA, meaning you're 70 and a half or older, the statute allows you to have your custodian to send directly to your 501c3, your church, your alma mater, whatever the case is, some legitimate 501c3 or legitimate nonprofit. And then you don't get a charitable deduction, but you also don't pay income tax on your required minimum distribution, and you can do that up to a maximum each year if your RMD is big enough of $100,000. So the mistake I made was that I included in IRAs, I also included 401ks and SEP IRAs, and that's a mistake. It actually is that you can do that only with IRAs. So, for example, let's suppose you had money in a 401k and you wanted to do, and you were subject to a required minimum distribution, excuse me, because even though you're no longer a plan participant, you left the money there, and or you have your own business and you have an SEP IRA and you're in a position where you have a qualified charitable you have a required minimum distribution, then the thing to do is to open an IRA, and you can then transfer without any taxes the amount of money that would be equal to what you want to do in terms of a qualified charitable distribution. So the money would go, for example, from your SEP, from your Carl Stewart SEP to your Carl Stewart IRA, and then you could do the qualified charitable distribution. So I want to thank Bob for making that note. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text 512-836-0590 or call me at 877-590-KLBJ. Patrick, can I take that call that's on the next line, please? Yeah, I see you're going to get me a name. Terrific. So, rather than bloviate, we have an incoming caller, and I am going to take this call. Here we go. Just hang on. Live radio, my friends. Here it comes. Gary. Gary, you're on the air. How may I help?
Yes, Carl. I had a question regarding stretch IRAs. I know that the bills going through Congress would eliminate them or change them.
Yes.
Do you know if existing stretch IRAs would be grandfathered or if we would have to eliminate those as well?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's no way, of course, of knowing. Based on my reading, I don't think that that legislation is going to have legs and get passed in the current term. And then you're into election time, and I think it would be difficult for a lot of members of Congress to come back and explain to people that they could no longer do this. When in my experience, and that's all that it is that when they change the rules, they draw a line in the sand, so to speak, and say, okay, from now on, anybody who does this is subject to the new rule. But if Gary, when what we're talking about here is if you have a non-spousal IRA beneficiary. So let's suppose Gary and I are married and we predecease our spouses and they get our IRA. And now, and we both of us have children. And so our spouse then, our surviving spouse, then puts the kids on as her beneficiaries. She passes away. There's still money in the IRAs. Under the current statute, those IRAs, they set up, and each child has one, called a beneficiary IRA, and they're required to take the money out based on their life expectancy, not based on their moms or their dads. And so if they're 45, just make that up, they've got a long life expectancy. Unless they take the money out because they want it, they can stretch that, hence the term stretch that Gary used, out over their life expectancy. And there's talk now, not talk, there's proposed legislation that says, no, if that scenario happened and Gary and I died and then our spouses died, the kids would have to take the money out within 5 years, which is obviously a real opportunity to get more taxes. My experience, Gary, is that they don't go back and make it retroactive. That's just been my experience, frankly.
Okay.
All right.
Very good. And can I ask you another quick one?
Of course.
Yes. I did a little looking a couple of years ago, and it looked to me like money that was in either a traditional or a Roth IRA earned about an extra 0.75% per year. I talked to an advisor where my 401k is, and they said, we consider it 1 to 1.5% a year. Does that sound right?
Oh boy, it adds, there are a lot of moving parts. So it depends on what your income tax bracket is and if you're subject to state or local taxes. In theory, you and I living in Texas, in theory, the returns ought to be less than if we lived in New York City, where we pay New York state tax and New York City tax. Because what they're alluding to is what you would have to make in a taxable environment to have the same return in an IRA or 401k. The other thing that makes it really interesting is you have to make some assumptions about returns in a taxable account and what the tax liability is on that. Because let's suppose you and I are in the 22% capital gains rate, which is the highest, but if we sell something, we don't pay capital gains on the whole thing. We only pay capital gains on the amount attributable to the gain. But when you and I take money out of our IRA, we pay income tax on the whole thing, right? Because we've never paid taxes on it. So I find that assertion it troubles me because I think there are just too many variables to make that kind of flat statement. And then, of course, the other thing that's a really big deal is if you're a saver and an investor, like I know you are, and you ultimately have money in your IRA, and you and your wife pass away, the kids are going to pay taxes as they take the money out. But if you had the same investments, you would have to pay taxes before you bought the investments with that money. But upon your demise, all those gains, if they're there, disappear, and your wife has a new step-up basis. And then upon her demise, all those gains disappear, and the kids have a step-up basis. And if they wanted to sell it, they'd pay zippity-doo-dah, no taxes. I would suggest that's a pretty big positive. So when I add all those things up in my feeble brain, I'm uncomfortable making that kind of assertion.
Okay.
All right?
Very good. Thank you, Carl.
You bet. Thanks for calling. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text. We're going to take a break, so call or text 512-836-0590 or call me at 877-590-KLBJ. I'm going to visit with Larry when I return. Welcome back. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Thanks for listening. When you have a financial or investment planning question, give me a call or text 512-836-0590 or call me at 877-590-KLBJ. Larry, you are on the air. How may I help?
Yeah, Carl, I started investing in an investment grade intermediate term.
Mm-hmm.
global bond portfolio. It is 70 domestic, 30% international, less than 5% emerging market.
Yeah.
It's about 50% sovereign.
Yeah.
And then the rest, well-diversified.
Yeah.
So, the old question, should I dollar-cost average or can I lump sum?
Yeah.
What do you, is it prudent to dollar-cost average or should I just lump sum?
Well, first of all, for the rest of our listeners, what Larry's talking about is there are two or three things that generally can be used to describe a bond mutual fund. One of them is its duration, which is similar to maturity. So Larry's talking intermediate term versus long-term or short-term. Secondly, it's either domestic, international, or the word global, which means both. And then also whether it can be investment grade or not. And when Larry is saying sovereign, that means that those bonds that are international bonds are issued by the governments, whether that's the government of Britain or the, you know, Germany or whatever the case is. Now, that's what we're talking about. So the benefit of dollar cost averaging is that it takes the plausible benefit, not always, but plausible benefit of the volatility of the underlying asset. And because bonds historically are substantially less volatile than stocks, then just intellectually, the benefit of dollar cost averaging is significantly diminished in a bond portfolio versus a stock portfolio. So in the case of a global bond portfolio, the two things that could cause prices to decline in any meaningful way would be a significant rise in global interest rates, or secondly, a significant rise in the dollar when compared to the currencies of the foreign bonds. Now, presumably,
Carl?
Yeah.
Okay, they're hedging this. It's an index portfolio, and the international is being hedged.
Okay, well, then that eliminates that. So what Larry's talking about is one of the benefits and one of the liabilities of investing internationally, whether it's stocks or bonds, is you have dollar risk and dollar reward, currency risk and currency reward, and Larry doesn't have that. Frankly, if I were in your shoes, given what you've told me about this, that you don't have currency risk, that it's intermediate in term, it's only 5% in, emerging, I'd probably go ahead and put the money in if I were in your shoes, Larry.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text 512-836-0590 or call me at 877-590-KLBJ. Tom, you are on the air. How may I help?
Oh, hi, Carl.
Hi.
Thanks for your programs the last 2 weeks, by the way. I found them very interesting. I'm sure most people did.
Oh, good. Thank you.
My question concerns municipal bonds.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out at what tax level, because we got the new tax program, would municipals kind of make some sense?
Right.
And if you do decide they make some sense,
would
you say at what point a bond itself would be appropriate versus a bond fund?
Okay. Two great questions. So are you married filing jointly or are you a single taxpayer?
Married.
Okay.
Filing jointly.
Okay. And more or less, what would you say is your annual taxable income?
Taxable would be about, after all the deductions are taken out, I would say probably around 75 to 80.
Okay. So I'm looking at the current tax code, or the current tax bracket, excuse me, and from $19,400 to $78,950, you're in the marginal tax bracket of 12%. And from $78,950 all the way up to $168,400, you're in the 22%. So you use your marginal bracket to do your calculation. So you look at a bond or a bond fund. If you look at a bond fund, you look at its trailing 12-month yield, which is all the dividends it's paid over the last 12 months, divided by the current price. And so if a fellow's in the 22% marginal bracket, what you can do is you can say, okay, then I'm going to take that yield, if you will, and I'm going to convert it to the taxable yield so that I can see if I can do better in the municipal or in the taxable. So I take that yield and I divide it by 78% in your case, 0.78, and that gives me, I'm sorry for all the jargon, that gives me what's called the pre-tax equivalent yield. Now I know what, if I look at a taxable bond fund and its taxable yield exceeds my pre-tax equivalent yield on my municipal bond, I'm better off in the taxable. In generally speaking, it's been my experience over the last 41 years that if you're in the 22% marginal bracket, the odds are, if you're comparing apples to apples, intermediate to intermediate, long-term to long-term, investment grade to investment grade, high yield to high yield, generally speaking, someone in the 22% bracket is better off staying in taxable bonds. Okay, that's the answer to the first question. The answer to the second question is really interesting because there's no right answer. Whereas I can be very kind of mathematical in the first part, the second part really depends on the individual. And we have some callers who love individual bonds. Now, let me argue the case for both of these. The benefit of owning an individual bond, unlike real estate, unlike stocks, unlike mutual funds, you know exactly what your future cash flow is going to be. You actually know when you're going to get it. And you also know when that bond's going to turn into par or $1,000. Whether you're alive or gone, you know when that bond's going to turn into par as long as the issuer doesn't default. So there's that certainty feature that you get with individual bonds. On the other hand, unless you're investing millions and millions of dollars, you don't get the diversification of a bond fund, and you don't get the, unless it's an index fund, you don't get the ability to actively manage it, to move up and down the maturity range or yield curve. And so what you lose when you buy the bond fund is you lose certainty. There's no way you know what the dividend is going to be every year forever, and you obviously don't have a future date at which you know you're going to get par value. I prefer bond funds for most investors because there's also the total return potential because they could go up in value and you could harvest that yield. And also, if you're running a balanced portfolio of mutual funds of stocks and bonds, let's pretend it's 60-40 stock bond and the stock market goes straight up and now it's 70-30, you can sell some stock funds and buy some bond funds. Let's suppose the stock market goes in the tank and now you're 50-50, you can sell shares of your bond fund and buy stock funds. You can't do that with individual bonds. So that's how I would evaluate it, Tom, if I were you. If I'm in the 22% bracket, the odds are a tax-exempt bond fund is likely not going to be advantageous. And as if you're trying to keep your portfolio evenly balanced because asset allocation, the mix of stuff you have, is the single biggest driver of return. And if you believe that, then the bond fund gives you that flexibility to accomplish that, and individual bonds simply do not. Okay?
Okay, very good. Thank you a lot.
You bet. Thanks for calling. We're coming to the bottom of the first half hour of our show. We have all of our lines available. That would make it a perfect time for you to call or text 512-836-0590 or call me at 877-590-KLBJ. Stick around for the second half of Money Talk. Welcome back to the second half of Money Talk. I'm Carl Stewart, and you're listening to News Radio KLBJ. Thanks for listening. We're here for another 27 minutes together. When you have a financial or investment planning question, give me a call or text, 512-836-0590, or call me at 877-590-KLBJ. You may listen online right now at newsradioklbj.com. Or you can go there at your convenience and download podcasts of the last several years of Money Talk. Here is a text I got this afternoon. Carl, I am retiring soon. What plan can I use for a 4% withdrawal rate? 60-40 stocks and bonds with a question mark. I am 60 years old. Okay. Well, this 4% withdrawal goes back many years to a seminal study done by a finance person, which asked the question, how much can you take out of a portfolio and not run out of money before you die, to put it bluntly? And so this individual ran lots of what-ifs using actual returns from stocks and bonds. I assume the S&P 500, that's typical. I assume the Barclays aggregate for the bond index. I don't know that. And came up with about a 65-35, 65% stocks and 35% bonds. You could take 4% a year and not kill the goose that lays the golden egg. And in some experts believe you can even increase that by the rate of inflation. Now, they also assume that it's that 4% of the previous year-ending value. Well, this thing is really fraught, because if you're retired and you've got two sources of income, Social Security and this withdrawal from your portfolio, it doesn't matter whether it's an IRA or not, it's a withdrawal. The taxes are different, obviously. What happens if you go into a bear market like from March of 2000 to September of 2002 and the S&P 500 drops more than 50%? Or what about this happens from September of 2007 to March of 2009 and the S&P drops close to 50%? Well, if you're taking 4% of the previous year-ending value and 65% of your portfolio drops 50%, have a nice day. You're going to have to reduce the withdrawals you take from your portfolio. Now, let's suppose you're 72 years old and you just retired and this happens. Boy, that's tough. So, yes, to answer your question, you could have a 60-40 portfolio. Then let me just layer on more uncertainty just to make your indigestion even greater. There's the old joke about the fellow who jumped out of the 15-story building on the way down. Someone said, how is it going? He said, so far, so good. So there's always the risk in the relatively short term that when you retire and you establish this, or you keep it in your 401k at that asset allocation, but you haven't been making withdrawals, and you make your withdrawals and we have a bear market. That's always a plausible risk, and it's always a short-term risk, because the other side of that, obviously, is if you retired at the beginning of the great bull market in 1995 and enjoyed 20% plus returns in your S&P for 5 years, you could be taking a lot more out. So here we are, 11 years into a rising market. Didn't go up every year, went down last year, went down 2015, as I recall, but it wasn't a 25 or 30% decline. What you have to think about is 4% a reasonable number? I don't know, because I can't tell what's going to happen this year, next year, and the next year. If I were king for a day and you're going to retire, I would do two things. I'd take a year's worth of my withdrawals out of the portfolio and put it in cash. I don't care what return I make. And secondly, I try to take out less than 4%. And if we do have a bear market or we have rising interest rates, you're putting 25% less stress on the portfolio in terms of withdrawals if you take 3 instead of 4. So that is a long-winded answer, first of all, because I'm a long-winded guy, and secondly, because it's just about the most important question that everybody has when it comes to retirement planning. Thanks for the question. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. I'm Carl Stewart. Call or text 512-836-0590 or call me at 877-590-KLBJ. Marianne, you are on the air. How may I help?
Hi, Carl.
Hi.
I spoke with you about this question, or one of my two questions anyway, some time ago, and that is that I have some funds. I added various amounts over a number of years, starting in 04, 05, one of the two different fund families.
Yeah.
And I'm told that on January 1, 2012, the fund companies had to keep track of what was paid to us as investors. And so they've sent me printouts those years. And
you
told me maybe a glass of wine and a lot of time.
Maybe a bottle of wine.
I think so. Maybe two of those over several nights. But we don't care in this column I'm going to add up for cost, right?
Yeah.
We know what I put in.
Yeah.
And then what I add up is the capital gains, whether they're long or short. We don't care about that. And the dividends, right? Those
right.
three
right.
items.
Because for the rest of our listeners, what Marianne's talking about is if she owns this mutual fund in her own name, not in an IRA or a tax-deferred account, every year this mutual fund is required to pay out dividends of any stocks that they held during that year, or if it's a bond fund, of any interest coupons they got during the year. And if they sold securities for gains and they sold securities for losses, and they had, after comparing those two, a net gain, they also have to pay that out. And what Marianne did, which is what all mutual fund shareholders, in my view, should do, is she reinvested those in additional shares at no cost to her. But she paid the taxes as she incurred those dividends and realized gains, because every year Marianne got a Form 1099, and it said this is what your taxable distributions were, and then she went ahead and paid income tax on the dividends, and she paid long or short-term capital gains on those and reinvested. So that increased her cost basis from the original money she put in plus the dividends and reinvested capital gains, raising her cost basis so that whenever she sells shares of that fund, she actually doesn't pay tax on the difference between what she paid for those shares and what she sells them for. She pays tax on the difference between what she paid for those plus the reinvested dividends and capital gains versus what she sold it for. Okay, Marianne, there you have it. Now go ahead, please.
Well, I'll do that.
Yeah.
It's just kind of disconcerting because I have several funds. And,
yeah.
So therefore, I'm not probably going forward using these kind of funds. I think the ETFs, if I can find satisfactory places, would make more sense.
I'm ambivalent. So first of all, if you buy an ETF of the S&P 500, and the S&P 500 has stocks and the stocks pay dividends, you're going to get the dividends, but you're not going to have capital gains in most ETFs, but you could have dividends. If you buy the Vanguard Total Bond Market, it's going to pay interest, which is dividends. You're going to have those dividends as well. So you're going to have, if it has current income, they got to distribute it. Where they're tax efficient is you're not going to have in most ETFs if they're handled properly. It's my understanding that one of their marketing concepts is that they're not going to distribute capital gains. So you're going to have income to the extent that the underlying securities pay it. Now, so are they more tax efficient than actively managed funds? The answer is probably yes. Probably yes. And so there's no reason not to do that. However, there's the investment case, and this is much trickier. So when index funds first started, it was just based on my recollection, and Jack Bogle came up with the idea of a market cap weighted index fund and started Vanguard. They just took the market capitalization of each stock and ranked them from the biggest to the smallest. But now we have sliced and diced these. So we have ones that are of just a large cap index like the Russell 1000, or just a small cap like the Russell 2000, or the Russell Value 1000 Value, or the Russell 2000 Growth. And then in addition to that, we've come along with these so-called factor, F-A-C-T-O-R, factor funds, where we're going to lean more towards low volatility stocks, or we're going to lean more towards value stocks. And so they're making active decisions, right, as to what names go into that fund. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm not opposed to that. But it's not passive investing the way Jack Bogle thought it was when he first started. And so that's okay as long as you're building a portfolio of ETFs and you understand what your market exposure is. The benefit is you're getting very low costs, right? The operating expenses are very low, and you're getting tax efficiency and hopefully eliminating realized capital gains. But you still got to make the investment case that you know what you're getting, because if you buy factor funds or you slice those markets into large and small, domestic and foreign, growth and value, you've got to realize you're doing that from an investment strategy standpoint, Marianne.
Well, thanks so much for going over all those details, because I'm going to study that. I'm going to probably listen to this program again.
Good. And have a glass of wine, young lady.
I'm going to do that.
Okay. Thanks for calling. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. We're down to our last quarter hour. I'm going to take a break. And you better give me a call or a text if you've got a question at 512-836-0590 or call me at 877-590-KLBJ. I'll be back. Welcome back to Money Talk. I'm Carl Stewart, and you're listening to News Radio KLBJ. A lot of fun this afternoon. Good questions. If you have a question, call or text because you're running out of time. 512-836-0590 or call me at 877-590-KLBJ. Here is another text. Carl, I have an inherited IRA that appears to have been set up to where the taxes are not paid by me on the distribution, but instead is paid by the trust, which unfortunately appears to be a much higher tax rate. Is there any strategy that can be used to move this money around in such a way that it is not subject to the higher tax rate? This really makes me, a good thing this isn't TV for many reasons. People tell me I have a great face for radio, but I've got my furrowed brow on because it has always been my understanding that if you make a trust your beneficiary of an IRA, trusts don't have a life expectancy, and consequently, upon your demise, all of that money has to be distributed to the beneficiary. So typically, the beneficiary of an IRA is not a trust, it's a human being. Now, if it's a human being, then as the taxes are taken out for the required minimum distribution, the custodian can set it up with the IRA owner to have a certain level of taxes taken out, 10 or 15 or 20 or whatever percent. They don't have to take the taxes out. It's still a taxable event, and you're still going to have to pay the taxes out of your pocket. So it's been my experience that most people who have an inherited IRA, what we call a beneficiary IRA, elect to have the custodian withhold a certain amount. But you're saying in your text that it's a trust which owns it. I've never encountered a trust IRA. I've encountered IRAs. They've always had human beings, and then there's a custodian. So I'm not sure about the trust. You are right that trust income tax rates are higher than individual income tax rates. And if you are the owner of the inherited IRA, you should be paying taxes at your marginal rate, meaning you take all your other sources of income, and then whatever you owe, then whatever you get from your required minimum distribution gets added to that, and you pay taxes at that rate. So sadly, I can't ask you a question because you texted me rather than call me, but I've not seen a trust actually be the owner. I've seen just a human being, and the tax rate is the human beings. So good luck. That's the best answer I can give you. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. I have all my lines available. Call or text 512-836-0590 or call me at 877-590-KLBJ. Here's another text. Carl, in what circumstance would a single premium immediate annuity make sense? I feel like for a small portion of one's overall allocation in one would help to ease the return needed from the other side of the portfolio as a withdrawal. Whoops, we're on a software that when someone sends a new text, the other one moves. I've just got to stop drinking before I come to the show here. Would help to ease the return needed from the other side as the withdrawal would be higher than the traditional 4% rule. Granted, the money you put in the single premium immediate annuity is gone when you die, whereas the other side would still be there to leave behind. That is a really interesting question. I was saying to Kenny during the break, you callers and texters are way too smart. Okay, so what this person is suggesting is, I'm retiring, and I need income from my portfolio. Rather than depending upon stocks and bonds or stock funds and bond funds, what if I took a piece of that money and I bought a single premium immediate annuity? What the heck is that? So that's when you take a pool of money and you give it to an insurance company And based on your age and your gender, they're going to pay you monthly income for the rest of your life. And the simplest ones, then when you die, they keep the rest. But if you outlive the money you get, if you give them $100,000 and you live to be 112 and get back $200,000, you win. But if you give them $100,000 and get run over by a truck the next day, not only do you lose because you're dead, but the $100,000 is gone. Now, you can buy various riders so that the return to principal is there, as an example, or your spouse continues to get income. You can do that. I'm not saying you shouldn't, but it obviously then reduces the income that you're going to get because the insurance company knows that they're going to be paying out more money if they've got another beneficiary or they have to pay back to your beneficiary the original amount invested. Now, does it provide guaranteed income? The answer is yes. And so from that standpoint, putting something in an SPIA, single premium immediate annuity, then takes some of the stress off of the portfolio because you're not having to take withdrawals, particularly during a period when asset prices are declining. Fine. The challenge is that when you put money in a single premium annuity, where does the money go? It goes to the insurance company. You'll be shocked to know that they're trying to make money. This isn't a charitable organization. So they're going to put it into their bond account. They're going to know how long you're going to live, just not you personally. And so as a result of that, they look at the return that they anticipate getting in their bond portfolio, and they want to make a profit and then pay out to you. So in a period of low interest rates, like now, that bond account is going to have a lower yield than in periods of high interest rates. So just by definition, the payout for a person the same age when 10-year treasuries yield 5%, excuse me, versus a period when 10-year treasuries yield 1.5%, obviously that lifetime payout on a monthly basis is going to be lower. And so you have to realize that. So it is not the best of times to buy a single premium immediate annuity. Now you can, if this weren't a text, you could say, yes, Mr. Smarty Pants, but if I buy 10-year treasury, I only get 1.5, and I'll get more in the SPIA because the money goes away when I die. I'm not opposed to this concept. If you can still have enough money as an inflation hedge invested in a stock and bond fund portfolio and you want to put some money in a single premium annuity and you've done your homework so you know that you've got a solid insurance company that's not going to go belly up and then you're going to have to go through the whole thing with the state pool, et cetera, then conceptually I don't have a problem with it. That's a terrific question. We're coming down to the end of the broadcast. I see that I have another text, so I'm not going to give out the numbers, and let's go. Carl, my husband is retiring after 30 years. They are offering him several types of a distribution, 100% and nothing to the beneficiary, 50% and then the beneficiary continues to receive the funds. There is a considerable difference, so we are thinking of getting a $1 million life policy and then selecting the 100% option. Would this be a good idea? Well, I've seen people, I particularly have seen this with military retirees where they retire at a relatively young age. They take the number one annuity option where they get the highest income, but they're concerned about their spouse. And so they buy a life insurance policy so that if they predecease their spouse or die at a young age, the life insurance death benefit shows up. It's not subject to income tax. And they feel better in sleep nights. And because that's a permanent need, you don't want to, you're going to have to buy expensive insurance. You want to buy whole life insurance because you don't want to ever have to worry about becoming uninsurable. You don't want to buy term and then have to turn around 15 years from now and it costs you an arm and a leg. So is this a reasonable thing to do? It is a reasonable thing to do. It is a safety kind of decision because what you're worried about is the mortality of the beneficiary. And if you are, if you think that's a plausible alternative, that could really happen because you're a lot older than your spouse or you come from a short-lived family or you think you may have a life-shortening type of disease, and is buying the insurance policy a good deal because you don't think you can make it and live a comfortable retirement on just the 50-50? And sadly, you didn't apparently don't get the 75% option like I see some teachers do. Do I think this is a plausible thing to do? The answer is yes. and you need to shop. The whole life insurance market is pretty what I would call efficient. You want to get several bids, that is several policies, because they'll take the same data, the gender, life. You have to take a physical. You got to do all that stuff. And if you get multiple quotes, and then you know that you've got a high quality insurance company, and you're comfortable that they're going to make good on the promise of the death benefit, then based on the way that you articulated the text, then I think that's a reasonable thing to do. Thank you. Well, we're down to about the last minute, so rather than try to take another question or look at another text, let me just say to you something that's big in the news if you follow these things, and that's the various broker-dealers going to zero commission. Schwab made a big deal out of that. It's my understanding that E-Trade has done it. It's my understanding that Ameritrade has done it. And that's fine. This is not a critical comment. I'm not saying this is bad. It's obviously good for the investors. Ask yourself, what's in it for Schwab? What's in it for Ameritrade? And what's in it for E-Trade? They're not in the business to lose money. You need to figure that out. And next Saturday, I'm going to tell you the answer. Been a great broadcast because you've made it that way. I want to thank Patrick for doing his usual terrific job. Once again, thank Dr. Rahmeyer for helping me the last 2 weeks. And to remind you, next Saturday, after the news at 4, be sure and tune in to Money Talk.